Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a founder that is doing some really exciting stuff. You know, I mean, they are growing, you know, really nicely. They've raised, you know, between equity and debt, you know, close to $500 million, which is really impressive. Basically, on the show today, we're going to be discussing how, you know, he came to the U.S., you know, that motivation that was behind it. You know, the immigrant story. I mean, obviously, as an immigrant myself, I love those stories because I really see myself in them. I love them. We're going to be talking about why, in the case of our guest, the competitive slide is always changing, and many more things, you know, when it comes to building, scaling, and all of the above. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Ricardo Pero. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Alejandro. Nice to meet you. Nice to be here.
So originally born in Brazil. Give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up over there?
Spent my first 20-something years in Brazil. Grew up pretty much in a farm in the south of Brazil. My family had that as a tradition, and I decided to take a different path in my career, study economics. And then when I was, 19, 20 years old, my dad passed, decided to make a shift. I changed my classes to the night shift, studying at night, working full time, became a treasurer, international treasurer of a Brazilian multinational company when I was like 21, 22 years old, built my career out of that. And then 2-3 years later, I got a job offer from Citi, and someone from their trading desk in New York resigned. They told me, why don't you start in São Paulo, go to New York on a temporary basis? And I stayed in New York on a temporary basis for over 20 years.
And one thing that that you were alluding to, I mean, when you were 19, you know, your dad passed, and that kind of changed everything for you. You know, how did that impact you, and also the way that you were thinking and the lens through, you know, you were seeing life around you?
It's interesting because I think people react in different ways when they face problems like this in life. My immediate reaction was, okay, I need to take ownership of my life. I cannot wait for someone to, you know, in Latin America, we have that, you know, relationship with our parents where there is a strong support and emotionally, financially support throughout the years and into your like mid-20s. And I realized that I wouldn't have the luxury to have that. So that was just like this. I mean, I didn't wait for anybody to tell me what I need to do. I just went there and did it.
So motivation for the U.S., you know, out of all places, you know, why come into the U.S.?
I came here for the first time in 1994. I went to New York. I was working already for this company, and I was meant to spend like 2 months work in a trainee program, working various departments of the bank, of like Citi and Chase back then. The company had strong ties with both banks. And for me, it was a life-changing experience because I knew, okay, I belong here. It was crystal clear to me that I needed to make that move. I was able to interact with a lot of people that thought like me, and this was very inspirational because you see, and you mentioned immigrants, and you see all these foreign college kids studying and building their careers, and I was working already out of college working in Brazil, and I said that's what I want to do. So I was going to be the first executive to be fully sponsored, to have an MBA sponsored by the Brazilian company, and I decided to decline that offer and take an offer from Citibank, who offered me a job here in New York, and together with my MBA. And I did my MBA the same way I did my college, studying at night and during the weekends, and working full time during the day.
How was the experience of the MBA? Because Colombia is really great. How was the community, you know, and how have you been, let's say, able to leverage that?
It was an amazing experience, networking experience for me. My health wasn't that, because I was always tired. I think I gained like 30 pounds during my MBA because I was drinking coffee and eating ice cream to keep awake during those long nights studying. But it was an amazing experience. I mean, it helped me create some concepts and rethink the way I saw businesses, because when you are an immigrant, you have this view of the world. And my experience studying the US helped me think in a different way. It helped me see the world with different lens and made me understand better some business dynamics and things that happen in the companies that I work, and made a tremendous impact in the business that I'm building.
So then in this regard, you know, let's talk about the corporate years, because obviously now, you know, you're riding this rocket ship that we're going to be talking, you know, about it in a while, in just a little bit, but you have, you know, you did experience corporate in different shapes and forms. I mean, you were talking about Citi, you did Morgan Stanley, then Mary Lynch, and then finally JP Morgan, which was your immediate step, you know, before really getting started, you know, with the company. So I guess, how was that transition, you know, from one institution to the other, and what were you doing?
So I started in sales and trading. I started trading FX, did FX and rates, then multi-asset classes. We built I was managing a JV between Salomon Smith Barney and Citi, covering mid-market institutions in LATAM. And we did an amazing job. It was really fun. And then 2007, I started noticing that a lot of my peers were leaving. And I decided to take a chance. I got an offer from Merrill back then. And I mean, I think that I did a good reading about Citi, because 2008 came. I think I probably, it wasn't my best choice going to Merrill Lynch. And I went through that acquisition of B of A. And it was a, you know, a weird experience, because I've stayed there for probably like 2 years, maybe less than 2 years. And then JP Morgan came, extended me an offer, and moving from one organization that is changing, going through an acquisition, to an organization that was well established, gaining a lot of momentum post 2008 crisis. It was a very interesting change for me. With Citi, you think about Citi pre 2008 crisis. It was a very global organization with businesses, you know, strong business in LATAM, strong ties to LATAM. Went to Merrill to build a similar business, and then everything fell apart. And then you go to JP Morgan. And at JP Morgan, I had a different challenge, because I wasn't only managing the relationship with some LATAM clients, and especially Brazil, but I was also bringing investment opportunities from LATAM to our US or my US, European and Asian counterparts. And it was a different environment, and that helped me also gain extra experience, extra exposure to foreign markets and working with a more international network of colleagues, and went to trips to Europe, to Asia, and so on. So it was an amazing experience back then. But at some point, after you do that for like 15, over 15, almost 20 years, I was starting to get a little tired of the corporate world and doing the same thing over and over again.
So let's talk about that, because that was the time where you were at JP Morgan, and that's the time where you decide that maybe, you know, there is something else that you should be doing, you know, maybe starting something of your own. What was that incubation process that, you know, got you to finally be like, okay, I'm giving my notice, and this is kind of like what I'm thinking about doing?
I knew for a fact that I wanted to leave, because I saw a lot of opportunities to grow both personally and professionally. I wanted to search for something that would challenge me in a way. And for 6 months or so, the only thing I did was research. I talked to a lot of my former clients. I promised myself that I would avoid to go back to work for a big bank doing the same thing that I did at JP Morgan. And I kept that promise. And one day I received a phone call from a friend of mine that was selling in e-commerce, had a wholesale business, moved his business to Amazon. And that call changed my life in a way, because that's probably why my attention, the opportunity that I saw there called my attention, and I built an entire company based on that.
So let's talk about that process then. So how was, you know, then, because I know that it was like a two-phase approach, you know, the way that you went about this. You know, first, you know, you started with essentially going at it with, you know, a different blend or a different structure, right? Where you got started with kind of like some friends and family, you know, money around a vehicle that you created. And then that ended up becoming, you know, what you guys are doing now. So what was that journey like? You know, how did you go from one end to the other one, where now, you know, it's finally becoming tangible?
Yeah, the business is a capital intensive business. So once I figure out, okay, this is what I'm going to build, I need to secure resources beyond what I have already saved and put aside to start my own business. And the first thing that I thought was how I can make this scalable and have an edge over it. So my two first hires were data scientists. And it was a big change for me, because I was applying a lot of my knowledge on areas that I had no expertise whatsoever, like data science, machine learning models, now called AI, and this was so new to me. I was coming from a trading desk environment, very open, very fast paced, and that demanded a lot of my brain power, attention, and long hours to work with those guys to build our first credit model. And it wasn't a...
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
Welcome, change.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So I guess then for the people that are listening to really get it, what ended up being the business model of Sellers Funding? How are you guys making money?
So we started as a lending platform to Amazon sellers. I soon realized that staying with Amazon alone would probably offer little to no differentiation to our customers and no value added to our shareholders. So I started integrating with other platforms. Nowadays, we have connectivity with almost 10 platforms, all e-commerce platforms. And the second wave of evolution was building a banking infrastructure to mitigate operational risk and start creating another layer of incentive for customers to stay with us for longer. So how we make business, it's a node banking model. You borrow money as cheap as you can, and you maximize your allocation of capital, right? So we make money providing working capital solutions to our clients. We make money offering a banking platform where they can pay their vendors either in dollars, euros, pounds. They can do cross-border payments and so on. The way I think about our platform, e-commerce is a global industry, and we need to have a global mindset to cover our target industry and our clients.
Okay, so then in that case, you know, I guess for you guys, what were the early days like? At what point do you realize, hey, I think that we're into something here?
A lot of people, when you read about entrepreneurship, you look at milestones. Like there is always that, the first $1 million in revenue, first $10 million in revenue, and we got into $1 million in revenue in like year one, or maybe less than that. And we saw a great traction. Before being called SellersFi, the company was called Sellers Funding. So it was a very high organic growth search engine for us. Or, when people went to Google and saw Amazon sellers funding alternatives, we were like one of the first ones to be there. So there was a lot of demand for our product. And then, and in my mind, we were positioning ourselves in an industry that had a secular trend, very positive coming our way. And then the pandemic hit, right? And then all the growth that we expected to achieve in five years happened in 1 year or two. And we had to be prepared for that. So I think the first time we surpassed $10 million in revenue was 2020. And And that was a big jump, like over 100%, 150% growth in that year. And we've been growing consistently over 100% year over year, with the exception of last year, where we grew about 50%, 40%.
Now, in this case, for you guys, you know, too, I mean, you've raised quite some money. How much money have you guys raised to date?
Over $500 million, and we are expanding that this year even further.
I know that $70 million has been in equity, and then the rest has been in debt. So, how does it typically work? You know, when you raise money for equity, and what is the difference with raising money for debt for a business like this?
The approach is a little bit different, and thankfully we've been proving that our technology and our credit underwriting models, they work. We disbursed over $1 billion. We wrote off less than 2.5% over that period of time. So from a debt point of view, the performance itself tells the story. From an equity point of view, we need to highlight not only the milestones and the growth trajectory that we face, but also the plans that we have for the future. And when I see the company moving forward, there is a big shift happening right now. And it started with our rebranding from Sellers Funding to Sellers Spy. The idea to change the mindset of our team here, starting with the team and going to our customers that think of us as a working capital provider. Now the idea is, and the challenge that we face is to change that mindset and having our customers think of us as a financial platform that has a strong working capital solution. But it's not only that. We are offering cards, we are offering bank accounts, FDIC insured bank accounts. And this is just the beginning of a much more robust financial platform.
So I guess as you're raising money here, I mean, especially as an immigrant too, no? And how is that journey like of building the network and, you know, making sure that you're able to go through the next cycles too, going from one round to the next? How was it like for you?
It's interesting. I remember the first trade show that I went with my business partner. We were questioned, how come two Brazilians decided to build an e-commerce, a lending platform for e-commerce sellers? Why not? I've been working for, you know, U.S. financial institutions for over 20 years or over 15 years. So it was a lot of skepticism from the get-go. And then there was, I was looking at our old presentations, and there's always that slide, right, that talks about the competitive landscape. And for us was always like, oh, you have an amazing track record, but you haven't scaled yet. Let's wait for you to reach $100 million in origination. And then you reach $100 million in origination, and then for lenders or credit folks, it was always like, oh, okay, you reach $100 million in origination, but you haven't faced a negative credit cycle. And here we are, like six years down the road. We've been through a lot. I mean, the last 2 years have been very challenging for lenders, especially finance in general. And we remain here. And when I look at that slide, that competitive landscape slide, a lot of our competitors, that companies that I admire and I consider benchmarks when we start the business, got acquired, changed their business models. We saw that happening the past 2-3 years again on a post-pandemic world. And we kept our discipline, and I think that we are doing something that is meaningful for a lot of our clients and, you know, a lot of our partners and to the point that we were able to secure this relationship with Amazon this year.
So I guess for the people that that are listening, you know, to get a good understanding, because obviously, you know, here you've raised quite a bit of money, you know, and I think that vision is a big one for the investors, also for the people that you're onboarding, you know, on the customer side, on the employee side. If you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision for sellers funding was fully realized, what does that world look like?
When I think about ourselves, I think as a neo bank for e-commerce sellers with strong embedded solutions for marketplaces. So I see us probably not in that long near future, but probably in the near future, in the next couple of years, probably a multi-billion dollar company. If I had to choose, I would say probably going public in 2-3 years, having surpassed, we are now approaching 5,000 clients, SMEs, predominantly in the US. I would love to expand that as an immigrant, like you said. I'd love to expand that to other places. I think that we are covering an underserved industry. And I don't know if you know, but over 50% of SMEs selling in the US are foreign companies. So if my goal to expand beyond the US market, supporting foreign companies selling in the US, but also expanding internationally. I think that the theme of underbanked is applicable to consumers, to small businesses. And we are in an industry that is extremely underserved and not properly understood by most traditional financial institutions.
So I guess we're talking about the future here, but I want to talk about the past and do so with a lens of reflection. If I was to bring you back in time, you know, maybe back in time to, let's say, 2016, where you are at JP Morgan and envisioning a world where you were to become an entrepreneur and bring something of your own to life. If you could have a sit down next to that younger self and being able to give that younger Ricardo one piece of advice for launching a business, what would that be and why, given what you know now?
That's a great question. I think I learned more about bad examples and not to fall into the same traps that I see people falling. And I look at our team today. We have a very low voluntary churn. And when I start the business, I would say pay attention to the team, but probably I should have been a little bit more generous on the stock option for the early, like the first 5-10 employees. Not that we don't have now. I think that I corrected that throughout time. We have over 70% of our employees have stock options in the company. That creates a sense of ownership. It took me a couple of years, or maybe less than 2 years, to understand that, how important that was for me. And I think we have an amazing team and we have an amazing culture here. Very diversified team with different backgrounds. And that is probably the most important aspect of the strongest foundation that I have in the business today. It's how amazing is our team here. And probably I would have spent more time forming that from the early months or a couple of years into the business. Probably I would be in a better position not to feel so overwhelmed and responsible for all the things that I did at the beginning. Not that it's an easy, I never expect an easy transition from being an employee to an entrepreneur. But having a team that supports you from the get-go is important.
So I guess for the people that are listening, Ricardo, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
You can reach me on LinkedIn by email, ricardo@salesfy.com.
Amazing. Well, easy enough. Well, Ricardo, it has been an absolute honor to have you with us today. So thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show with us.
Thank you very much. It was an amazing experience. Thank you a lot.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.